We continue to process what happened last week at the U.S. Capitol, starting with, how was it even possible?
There was a major intelligence failure. And I think what's going to need to happen is similar to what happened after 9/11.
Also, technically, was it a coup d'etat or not? Some say that's missing the point.
Just because it didn't have a high likelihood of succeeding in a classic coup fashion doesn't mean it wasn't an attempt and this wasn't real.
We hear from Fiona Hill. Also on the show, as thousands die each day from COVID-19, life for many of us just goes on. Once the numbers get too big, it's hard for humans to make emotional sense of them.
There's a saying, statistics are human beings with the tears dried off.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Incitement of an insurrection. Four words that explain what the House of Representatives is charging President Trump with. The House is expected to move quickly and vote midweek on impeachment, the second impeachment proceeding against Trump in less than a year. Last go round, you'll recall Fiona Hill was a key witness. Hill was President Trump's top Russia advisor from 2017 to 2019 and also on the National Security Council. She says Wednesday's storming of the Capitol building did not come out of the blue.
A lot of people are saying, it couldn't possibly have been a coup. It didn't succeed. The military wasn't out on the streets. The president wasn't using his formal powers, or it just didn't happen. You know, this was just a mob, an insurrection. But it's important to look down all of these elements, because just because it didn't have a high likelihood of succeeding in a classic coup fashion doesn't mean it wasn't an attempt and this wasn't real. So, as I'm saying, we're not out of the woods yet. One could imagine there could be factions of people within the military or veterans, which we've already seen, not just thinking about all of the right wing and other militias that have been taking this stand in support of the president. That's when it gets incredibly dangerous. We've seen a slow rolling attempt. It wasn't just a one-off on January 6th. It's been building up for quite some time. And we've got a lot of concerns about what might happen outside of the presidency once we get past the inauguration. And then there's also a lot of worries about the threats, possible threats to the inauguration itself.
Fiona Hill, you've used the phrase soft civil war to describe the U.S. right now. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, I mean, we're obviously not in a full-blown conflict here, but we've seen plenty of violence on our streets. So there were plenty of people in Capitol Hill who were wearing weapons and body armor. Obviously, on the internet, there's been a lot of instigation to violence and people forming and threatening violence, people threatening to kill the vice president, George Soros, all kinds of different bogeymen and women. And, this is all the elements of a civil conflict. If we were looking at another country, we would be greatly disturbed by this. And so, what I'm worried about moving forward is that this hardens. Because if you have 74 million people who have voted for President Trump, now, of course, not all of these are active supporters of the president or certainly not actively engaged in considering taking some kind of violent action in his support. But even if a relatively small percentage of them are, and there's been a lot of polling that's actually quite disturbing in terms of the scope and scale of the number of people who believe, first of all, that the election was stolen from him, and others who said that they pretended prepared to take action, then we're in really big trouble. And so it's very important how we address this. I mean, otherwise, again, it is going to be a civil war that sort of spills out even further onto the streets.
Right. So this is a long-term concern. I'm wondering about the next 9 days before the inauguration. I mean, you're a historian, Fiona Hill, with a deep knowledge of Eastern Europe and Russia. And based on what you know about authoritarian regimes, what worries you most in the next 9 days of the Trump presidency?
Well, it worries me that our democratic institutions, don't take action here. We also have to, whatever action we take, and I know there's a whole load of discussions right now going on about should he resign, should he be forced to resign, should the 25th Amendment be enacted, should there be another impeachment. Whatever we do, it has to be done very clearly, very plainly, with plenty of discussion, and also legally by the book, because we have to be able to defend these actions after the fact, because that would be, part of the mechanisms for re-establishing democratic norms. However, if we handle this correctly and we show that we can correct our mistakes, which the United States has done in the past, I think we can be an example to others of a democratic success. We can fix this, but only if we are very systematic, methodical about it, and very transparent.
With the U.S. national security apparatus focused on this crisis, how vulnerable is the U.S. to adversaries? And do you have reason to believe foreign infiltrators were in the mix of the Capitol building on Wednesday?
There's an incredible risk. I mean, I haven't got any personal reason to believe this, and I haven't seen any reports, but there's an incredible risk. Because anytime you have something like this, especially as it was telegraphed for weeks in advance, I mean, the president, I've even got on my answering machine at home one of these robot calls asking me to go down to the rally on January 6th.
Wow.
You know, the Save the America. I'm sure lots of people got it. I mean, I've talked to a few other people who came home and found this on their answering machines. People were being asked to go down to the rally. And so if you're a thoughtful, premeditated foreign adversary, you might well think of infiltrating the crowd and sending people down there, because it certainly wasn't being, let's say, scoped out and observed in the way that one would hope. I mean, there wasn't any background checks with people who were coming in on the buses. So who knows, you know, who was also using the opportunity to get into the Capitol. And certainly there's now been a great deal of concern about the stealing of laptops and other information from inside the building, and not really kind of clear what was taken. And they've swept the building, but, you know, I mean, I'm hoping that they're doing more thorough sweeps as well to see if any other things could have been planted there. But yes, it's an enormous concern, and we should always be concerned at these times of great vulnerability, because we've exposed ourselves.
Fiona Hill was President Donald Trump's top Russia advisor from 2017 to 19. She was also a key witness in the impeachment proceedings last year. Fiona Hill, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Marco.
And later this hour,
there are people that were involved in either a negligent or intentional failure to secure the Capitol. They're on the hook.
A former FBI special agent breaks down what went so wrong at the Capitol last week. Right now, the hottest commodity on the planet is the COVID-19 vaccine. And if you're a country in a position to provide vaccines, you might have some pretty powerful leverage. Many less wealthy nations are not turning to the U.S. and Europe. They're turning to China for help. Yang Zhonghuang has been following this. He's a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations and also director of global health studies at Seton Hall University's School of Diplomacy and International Relations. Where has China actually promised vaccines? And is there a time frame in place of when countries can expect to receive them?
Last fall, we have seen the Chinese government leaders and officials, you know, making all the pledges, you know, to the countries in the developing world, you know, especially those in sub-Saharan Africa, Middle East, South Asia, that they're going to receive the priority access to the Chinese-made vaccines. But now we are actually seeing something, I think, a slightly changing tone there. It seems that they're no longer highlighting the free donation of the Chinese vaccines. They are now more emphasizing the cooperation between China and the countries in the developing world in accessing the Chinese-made vaccines.
Do you see vaccines as kind of a soft power tool for China?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. By making those pledges, or by helping mitigating, you know, this gap of access between the developing countries and the developer countries, China actually not only helped mitigate that gap, but also portrayed itself as a benign global power.
So if the essence of diplomacy is carrots and sticks, let's say for China, the vaccine is the carrot, what is a stick? I mean, could China extract political agreements in exchange for vaccine access?
Well, that could be one of this hidden agenda of the vaccine diplomacy. You know, basically, especially when you are dealing with countries, for example, you know, you have territorial disputes with, you know, by promising and providing the desperately needed vaccines, you expect them to soften their positions. You are dealing with those countries.
And what territorial dispute were you referring to there?
Well, I'm talking about, for example, in Southeast Asia, right? China, this is like a strategically important region to China, where you have China making these pledges to countries like Cambodia, you know, Myanmar, Indonesia, and others.
What about the inverse of vaccine diplomacy? If China does not follow through on its promise to deliver vaccines, or if there are issues with the vaccine itself, could that be a big problem for these relationships?
That is indeed a concern now, especially now China seems to be increasingly prioritizing its domestic vaccine needs. Minister of Foreign Affairs Wang Yi, when he wrapped this trip to Africa, you know, he didn't make any single concrete vaccine commitment to the continent. So that raises the concerns whether, you know, China actually overpromised. You know, that is certainly not good news, you know, for successful vaccine diplomacy, because countries might feel like China reneged upon its promises. You know, they might turn to other countries like India or even Russia, right, to gain the access to the vaccines.
I mean, we've also seen countries like Ukraine, an ally of the U.S., turn to China for vaccines after Trump's ban on vaccine exports. I mean, should the U.S. be worried about what that could all mean for the future, or should they see possible the diplomatic benefits of the vaccine?
China was able to practice this vaccine diplomacy precisely because the U.S. is not a player in this game, right? Because, you know, we, through that, the so-called vaccine nationalism, you know, we basically focus on the needs of the domestic population. You know, we did not join the COVAX pillar, right, supported by the WHO. You know, we didn't even mention, right, that the U.S. is going to earmark, you know, a certain proportion of our vaccines, you know, for other countries. You know, so, you know, that allow, you know, countries, you know, like China, you know, and Russia to fill this void, right, left by the United States. You know, so the countries, you know, certainly in a way, they feel like alienated by the United States, while you have, you know, the other countries lend you a helping hand, you know, feel like certainly taking a more favorable attitude, you know, toward, you know, those countries.
Yangzheng Huang is a senior fellow for global health at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Try and hold your breath for this next story, about 2 minutes. Need some help? Stig Severinsen from Denmark demonstrates his breathing technique. He knows what he's doing. He's a free diver, people who dive underwater with no oxygen tanks. Severinsen was just confirmed by the Guinness World Record for smashing the distance record while swimming with fins. On just one single breath, Severinsen swam 662 feet underwater, not far below the surface. That's like covering a distance more than two times the height of the Statue of Liberty without coming up for air. Here's Severinsen telling 60 Minutes how he glides through the water.
In the beginning, you have to be streamlined, so I stretch my arms out. I'm sure that I'm very hydrodynamic, so I don't have resistance from the water.
Severinsen also holds the record for distance swimming under ice with one breath. And here's a good one for his resume. He once held the record for longest breath, 22 minutes. Yep, he held his breath for 22 minutes while in a water tank. Severinsen spoke about his passion for free diving during a TED Talk in Denmark.
People always ask me, Steve, why do you have to be so extreme? But to me, it's not extreme. It's not extreme at all. I'll tell you what is the most extreme. Life. Or going for milk.
Severinsen continued, if you venture outside for milk, you could get hit by a car. The 47-year-old broke the record in November in Baja California, Mexico, but it just became official. Severinsen said he attempted the free swim record to advocate for environmental awareness and chose an area threatened by plastic pollution and what he called the human lifestyle. He said after the pandemic hit, he wanted to remind people about our priorities for nature. Stig, consider us reminded. We'll be right back. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. With just 9 days left for the Trump administration, today a big shift in U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, which could have long-lasting effects. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the U.S. will designate Yemen's Houthi rebel movement a foreign terrorist organization. This could seriously complicate future efforts to deal with Yemen's humanitarian crisis and bringing the war there to an end. With us is the Yemen spokesperson for the Norwegian Refugee Council, Riona McCormick. She joins us from Aden. We need a quick reminder, Riona, who the Houthis are and what they represent to the State Department, specifically under Mike Pompeo.
Ansar Allah are otherwise known as the Houthis, and they are the movement that took over the capital of Yemen, Sana'a, about 5 years ago, which sparked the US to get involved in a Saudi-led coalition in support of the Yemeni government to attempt to remove them. The significance for the United States has been that there are accusations that the Ansar Allah movement are backed by Iran, which of course for the US has broader regional considerations. And so it seems clear that this latest move is part of that regional strategy to try and minimize Iranian influence in the region.
This is quite fresh news. What is the reaction from Yemen? Do most people think this planned designation of Houthis as foreign terrorist organization was politically motivated?
Well, the news came in for us in Yemen time just this morning. So people are really trying to get to grips with it at the moment. There's been mixed reactions here in Yemen. Ansar Allah, otherwise known as the Houthis, have come out and in turn accused the United States government of acting in a terrorist way. Other reactions from aid organizations have been the same message that has been given to the United States government for the last few months when such a move was being suggested, which is that on many levels, this would be catastrophic and it would certainly have a widespread impact on the humanitarian situation here and the ordinary millions of Yemenis who are trying to live their lives.
Your organization, the Norwegian Refugee Council, what are you looking at?
We're concerned about what the implications of this are going to be for our ability to run an office, hire staff, get goods into the country, get critical supplies like food and water and supplies to help fight COVID around the country to the communities who need it the most, get materials for building emergency shelters. And more widely, the kind of impacts that we're looking at are that really the feeling is that this would be devastating for the Yemeni economy, which is already in ruins after more than 5 years of sustained violent war.
So is it your expectation that the incoming Biden administration will reverse this planned decision to label the Houthi rebel movement a foreign terrorist organization?
It may not be possible to reverse this decision. And if not, then it is possible to put in place the kind of protections and safeguards that are needed. So these would be safeguards immediately for all humanitarian activities and humanitarian supplies. It would be also safeguards so that imports of critical food and other supplies can come in and out of the country. That would go a long way towards mitigating or softening some of the impacts of this designation. As for the rest, I suppose we will have to see on the 20th of January when the new administration comes in. We are asking for the Biden administration to make Yemen one of its number one priorities on day one.
Riona McCormack, the Yemen spokesperson for the Norwegian Refugee Council, speaking with us from Aden. Thank you very much, Riona.
You're very welcome.
The worldwide death toll from COVID-19 is approaching 2 million people. Here in the U.S. alone, around 375,000 people have died from it. Nearly as many American service members were killed in World War II. And yet, as thousands more die each day from the virus, life continues on for many people as if they are not affected. Paul Slovic is a professor of psychology at the University of Oregon and calls these circumstances psychic numbing. When he spoke with my colleague Carol Hill, Slovic explained we humans struggle to get emotional about numbers.
Our feelings are strongly engaged when there's one person in danger. I mean, we will risk our life to rescue a person nearby who's in danger of dying. But as the numbers increase, we can't make that same emotional connection to the people beneath the surface of the numbers. And so if two people are in danger, it doesn't feel twice as serious as one. It may feel a bit more serious or the same or maybe even less serious.
Is it because you can't kind of identify and see and connect emotionally with a particular person? Or is it because somehow your brain calculates if there's more than one or many, I can't possibly save those people?
In part, when there are a lot of people at risk, it can trigger this sense of inefficacy. As you say, you know, there's so many at risk, I can't do it all. And what we've learned there as well is that our feelings deceive us. That's because, you know, we help others, first because they need our help, second, we feel good about helping them. And if your attention is drawn to the fact that there's other people that you can't help, it doesn't feel as good. And so then you may not even help.
How are you seeing this kind of psychic numbness around this pandemic?
What we see is that, you know, every day there are reports, the latest statistics come out. So how many new cases, how many new deaths, and so forth. When the new totals come in, you won't feel any different, you know, when another 2,000 or 3,000 people are added to this large number. It's just a statistic. There's a saying, statistics are human beings with the tears dried off. What we know is that you need those tears. You need those tears to motivate action.
Now that we're in the middle of this pandemic, things aren't going so well. Lots of people are still dying. We're waiting for vaccines. We're still sitting and living in the middle of a crisis. How do we counteract these psychological tendencies to kind of tune out or not have the empathy we should?
So what we need to do is pause, look at the statistics, look at the data, listen to the experts who are thinking slowly and do understand the magnitude of this crisis, and try to imagine the individual lives beneath the surface of these statistics. We also have to recognize that some of the things that the experts are recommending as important at this time, like wearing masks, socially distancing, these things are very difficult for people to maintain over time. And that's where another psychological principle comes into play that kind of gives us problems here. And that's what we call reinforcement. That is, we don't feel an immediate reward for wearing a mask, but we feel an immediate cost. The mask is uncomfortable. Social distancing keeps us from doing things we like to do. So we feel the cost and not the benefit. You don't see that you're, you know, whether you're protecting someone or you're being protected from them. So it has to be a coordinated dance between the scientists, government, and people with their weird psychology. We have another saying called the more who die, the less we care when we're relying on our feelings. And that is a perverse arithmetic that we have to recognize within us, and we have to set up regulations and listen to experts in order to overcome that.
We were hearing there from Paul Slovic, a professor of psychology at the University of Oregon. He was speaking with my colleague, Carol Hills. You're listening to The World. As a mob stormed the U.S. Capitol, American journalists and politicians compared the events to Latin America and the Arab world.
You know, it's exhausting and it's frustrating.
Some say, hold on, America is not as exceptional as it thinks. Also ahead, Trump heads to Texas tomorrow to tout the border wall. That's coming up in the next half hour on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. We've gotten more details in the last few days about what happened at the U.S. Capitol last Wednesday. Some of those details are hard to stomach. Rioters beating down a police officer on the Capitol steps and chanting death threats against lawmakers and the vice president. Many questions remain unanswered, starting with how was this even possible? And what does the threat look like over these final 9 days of the Trump presidency? To explore these questions, we're joined by Asha Rangappa. She's a former FBI special agent and a senior lecturer at Yale University's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs. Asha, in terms of national security, how was this violent incident with security seemingly caught off guard? How was it even possible?
It's hard for me to understand. Ordinary protests in the Capitol have more security than what this appeared to have. If you go back to, say, the Women's March or the March for Science, things like that, which have no real expectation of turning significantly violent. And this one, you know, there were signals in open forums that there was planned violence. And normally this would result in a clear intelligence threat assessment. It would be shared among all of the internal agencies like the Department of Homeland Security, the FBI, sent to the Capitol Police. So I think basically there was a major intelligence failure. And I think what's going to need to happen is similar to what happened after 9/11. There is going to have to be a reconstruction of events and find out who dropped the ball and why.
You're saying, though, that a lot of this discussion about marching on the Capitol, about marching on Capitol Hill, was out in the open, right? So isn't it safe to assume that intelligence agencies like the FBI had this information in advance?
They had to have. The director of the FBI, Christopher Wray, has testified multiple times in the last year to Congress that white nationalism, right-wing groups were the greatest domestic terrorism threat. So I can't speculate. All I can tell you is that it doesn't make sense. I don't think it makes sense to anybody with any kind of intelligence or security background to understand what happened.
I mean, you're basically saying that the FBI saw the smoke, but they did not send the fire engine. I mean, are you seeing any evidence that anyone intentionally stood down or were ordered to?
The FBI appears to have been waiting for the Capitol Police to request assistance. And it's not clear when that happened, though that should have been coordinated beforehand. And then we do know that at the Department of Defense, they were denying explicit requests to call in National Guard assistance. Like I said, I think we're in kind of the aftermath of 9/11. I think there should be a commission similar to what happened after 9/11, which really parsed through this over the course of a couple of years, basically, and was able to piece together how this occurred.
Yeah, I use the FBI, Asha, only as an example of one law enforcement agency. It sounds like you're saying it is a complex system and the whole thing failed to some degree or another. Am I right?
The whole thing failed. Yes, this was not solely the FBI's responsibility. This was the FBI. This was the Department of Homeland Security, the Capitol Police, the Department of Defense. This was the mayor of D.C. And basically, this attempted coup failed. And so there are people, whoever they were, that were involved in either a negligent or intentional failure to secure the Capitol, they're on the hook.
So from a legal perspective, Asha, do you believe President Trump is responsible for inciting the storming of the U.S. Capitol? And in this kind of space where nobody's in charge, how hard will it be to prove that?
In terms of criminal liability, there are a couple of statutes. One is called rebellion and insurrection, and it criminalizes incitement of violence with the purpose of resisting the authority of the United States by force or impeding the functions thereof, which is clearly what was going on. And I think it's not just the speech that he gave that day. His speech that he gave that day has to be seen in a longer pattern of encouraging violence, of endorsing violence, using words like civil war, not committing to a peaceful transition. People will need to take matters into their own hands. You know, I mean, he told them that he was going to go with them to the Capitol and that they needed to show strength. And so the criminal bar is a high one. The elements have to be met and it has to be convincing to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt.
I mean, it's also possible that Trump could be saying all of this and not be calling at the same time. He could argue this, his lawyers could argue this, and not be calling for the storming of the Capitol.
That's what he's going to argue. But incitement is defined as, you know, anything that is likely to result in imminent lawless activity. In other words, if it's foreseeable based on what you are doing and what you are saying, that this is the kind of fire in the crowded theater. This is the threshold at which speech becomes criminal.
Well, as you know, the Democrats in Congress called on Mike Pence and the Trump cabinet to invoke the 25th Amendment to remove Trump. Lawmakers are also looking at the possibility of a second impeachment. What's at stake if there are no or just even minor consequences for either Trump or the rioters?
I mean, what's at stake is our democracy. This was a president of the United States who was unable to accept the outcome of a free and fair election and incited a mob to challenge the authority of the government, which he, by the way, leads, in order to stop it from functioning and to allow him to continue in power. If you don't even create the documentation that that is unacceptable and will be punished, then you are essentially inviting future would-be authoritarians to use the same playbook.
Asha Rangappa is a former FBI special agent and a senior lecturer at Yale University's Jackson Institute for Global Affairs. She's been speaking with us about the national security implications of the storming of the U.S. Capitol building last week. Asha, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
It's been hard to describe what happened last week in Washington, literally finding the language for it. The World's Sarah Birnbaum looks now at the American media coverage and the words we're using.
Over the past week, there's been some hand-wringing over what the siege on the Capitol says about who we are as America. Politicians, both Democratic and Republican, compared what happened to the Middle East or to Latin America.
This is banana republic crap.
As a student of foreign policy, if somebody described to me the actions that we saw, I would have assumed we were in a failed nation or a banana republic.
This reminds me of the time I spent in Iraq in 2007 and 2008.
Journalists made the same comparisons. For instance, here's Martha Raddatz of ABC News.
We are in America where this is happening, on Capitol Hill. I'm not in Baghdad. I'm not in Kabul.
Youssef Munayyer, a fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C., was watching this coverage.
It's exhausting and it's frustrating.
Frustrating for two reasons.
First of all, it's plainly Orientalist. It essentializes the Middle East and, you know, to a lesser extent, Latin America as, you know, a faraway land where there's barbaric violence, and that's all we seem to know or understand about this region.
And the second reason?
It perpetuates this myth about American exceptionalism. There's this idea that somehow these sort of things don't happen in the United States.
Newsflash, they do. According to Freedom House, a Washington-based think tank, democracy has been on the decline in the U.S. for the past 10 years. They cite factors like attacks on the press, pressure on judicial independence, and runaway executive power. And in some sense, the U.S. was never very democratic, says Munayyer.
We've had a terrible bloody civil war here, and we've had a long legacy of violence directed at minorities, directed at African Americans here, that have been part of the founding of this country.
And yet, he says, the idea of American exceptionalism persists. Case in point, Joe Biden's speech last week reacting to the events.
Like so many other Americans, I am genuinely shocked and saddened that our nation, so long the beacon of light and hope for democracy, has come to such a dark moment.
No, this is exactly who we are. Our democracy is not different than others, and our democracy can also fail.
Pedro dos Santos is a political scientist at the College of St. Benedict and St. John's University in Minnesota. He's been thinking a lot about what happened on Wednesday.
I studied Latin America, so that's where I go normally, right? You know, my brain. So the first thing to come to mind was Hugo Chavez in 1992.
Chavez led a coup attempt in Venezuela. It was unsuccessful. In this short speech on national television, Chavez joked that he had only failed for now. After that, Chavez became a political star and was elected president a few years later. Dos Santos sees a parallel in what Trump did last week.
Trump clearly understands that he lost, but he's already eyeing 2024. So that's why Hugo Chavez came to mind as somebody who did something that they knew was probably not going to be successful, quote unquote, at that moment, but planting a seed that could eventually lead to something in the future.
We're wired to think comparatively, to look for parallels, to find resonances. And Dos Santos says there's value in doing that.
Because then we can see where there are some patterns that have happened before that can help us understand, I wouldn't go as far as say predict, but understand what is happening in any country, including the United States.
However, there's a difference between thoughtful analysis and relying on stereotypes, like this off-the-cuff remark on CNN.
Yeah, it's just surreal. I feel like I'm talking to a correspondent reporting from the, you know, Bogota.
Bobby Ghosh has heard it all before, and not just from Americans.
I've been in Baghdad when people have looked at something that's going on in Baghdad and say, we're not Tehran. I've been in Bombay and people have seen something go on and people say, we're not Baghdad.
Ghosh works for Bloomberg and spent years as a foreign correspondent. He's been to a lot of conflict zones.
When I was in Iraq as a reporter there, when the Shia-Sunni violence broke out in 2006, 2007, Iraqis from both sides would say the same thing, that no, this is not us. I heard it in India when Hindu mobs were killing Muslims or going on a rampage. Lots of Indians, Hindus as well as Muslims, would say, that's not us.
Ghosh says when countries, when societies, when individuals are confronted with something monstrous from within, there's a very human tendency to deny it.
And to distance yourself away from it emotionally, morally, and say, that's not us.
The scenes of chaos at the Capitol do not reflect a true America. Do not represent who we are.
This is not who we are as a country.
This is not who we are.
When Ghosh hears this stuff from Americans, he says he doesn't want to slap them and say, wake up, smell the roses. Instead, he says he's sympathetic.
What it is really is not so much that's not us, but that's not who we want to be.
It's not so much a rejection of reality, he says, as much as it's a longing for a different reality. For the World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
It is hard to forget this rallying cry from Trump's early campaign days back in 2016.
We will build the wall, believe me. And who is going to pay for the wall? Who?
The crowd chanting Mexico there. The border wall was a signature promise of Trump's presidency, and tomorrow, with just days left in office, Trump will head to Texas, to the border. He'll highlight what has been built, concrete and steel segments of wall, physical symbols of the administration's crackdown on immigration. For a reality check on this and other immigration news, the World's immigration editor Monica Campbell is with me. Monica, the expectation is that Trump is going to point to the border wall in Texas tomorrow as an achievement. Promises made, promises kept. How accurate is that, though?
It's not the wall he wanted. We didn't see the big, beautiful wall that stretched along every mile of the U.S.-Mexico border, nearly 2,000 miles. That did not happen. In reality, during the entire Trump presidency, we saw about 450 miles of wall built. A lot of that, though, was replacement wall, which was significant. Much larger pieces and sections of fence built up where there wasn't much before. And Mexico did not pay for the wall. About $15 billion were spent on this project, a lot of that coming from the military budget.
So that's the literal concrete part of Trump's immigration scheme. Policy-wise, though, for the past 4 years, it seemed like nearly every week there was news on how the Trump administration was hardening the U.S. immigration system, making it tougher to come here, tougher to stay here. In the past few days, though, some important pushback on those policies. What's happened?
Yeah, in the last few days, we've seen federal judges across the United States block a raft of changes that the administration wanted to actually start to implement today that would involve the asylum system, make it much harder for people to try and seek asylum in the United States. The bar would be raised in many ways. Applications would be tougher. Judges would have more power. We also saw a judge reject the administration's push to allow states and localities the right to reject resettling refugees. Normally, refugees are resettled throughout the United States and given assistance at the local level to get a job or housing or that sort of thing. And we'd never seen an attempt to try and create some sort of division with how refugees are resettled within the United States.
So it sounds like Biden might have some judges on his side. What are the expectations, though, that Biden will go bold on immigration now that the Democrats control the Senate? How far could the pendulum swing?
It's interesting that you bring up judges because Trump appointed plenty of judges, immigration judges. So Biden will face considerable challenges when it comes to that, you know, kind of at the ground level of decision making when it comes to immigration. At the larger level, sure, he's got Democrats now, you know, in the Senate. That may make the push for more comprehensive, bolder immigration reform a lot easier. But there's also this idea of, you know, what we're going to see with the Biden administration, at least in terms of immigration, is that you're going to have this huge desire for strong change, you know, strong, swift action when it comes to immigration to reverse what Trump was so aggressive on from day one. There is concern that that pendulum swing may be, you know, really abrupt. And I spoke with Sarah Pierce about this. She's an analyst with the Migration Policy Institute in D.C.
I don't think it's healthy for the institutions of the United States to be swinging, you know, back and forth between administrations. I don't think that's good for the institutions, for due process, or just for people's expectations about how the U.S. immigration system works.
Yeah. On the other hand, Monica, the U.S. is now a long way from the lines of that Emma Lazarus poem at the Statue of Liberty, give us your tired, your poor. What are you going to be watching for in the first few days or weeks of the Biden presidency when it comes to immigration?
The Biden administration's immigration policy proposal to Congress, right? That's going to be something that we'll pore over. I'm also interested in enforcement. How is Biden going to tackle kind of the culture of ICE officers, Border Patrol officers, many of whom were very loyal to Trump, and how there might be kind of a disconnect between what Biden says on high and how kind of the culture of enforcement is playing out on the ground between officers and immigrants?
The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell. Monica, thanks very much for this.
You're welcome.
There's a planned art installation of the Statue of Liberty that's going up in the Hungarian capital, Budapest. This one is small, though, only 3 feet high. It'll be on display for just 2 weeks. Already, though, it's led to controversy, as the World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, reports.
When Hungarian artist Peter Soloway began work on his statue, he had an inkling it would prove controversial. It's a kneeling sculpture of the Statue of Liberty, illuminated in rainbow colours. Her right hand is raised in a fist, and her left holds a tablet, not depicting the date of the Declaration of Independence, but the words, Black Lives Matter. Soloway tells me that even as he was creating the sculpture, he kind of expected it would be destroyed when it goes up in April.
I was counting on this possibility. Tearing down statues is a sad tradition in Hungary.
The installation is just one of a series of public artworks commissioned by a local mayor in Budapest. But it's the only one that has triggered such a backlash. Commentators on pro-government TV shows have even compared it to erecting a statue to Hitler. Hungarian activist Gregory Giras says right-wing pundits make these outrageous statements for a reason.
Obviously, nobody really believes it. They know what they are doing. They just use issues that divide the people to distract from the fact that democracy is over in Hungary.
The black community in Hungary is small, not even 1% of the population. Giras is also a reggae singer. He organised the largest Black Lives Matter march in Budapest last year. But he says it's really the Roma community that bears the brunt of racist attacks, although his wife, who's half Hungarian, half Ghanaian, has experienced verbal abuse. And Giras says racism appears to be on the rise in the last few years.
It started in 2015 with the refugee crisis, when the prime minister decided that this is the topic that will lend him total control over the country.
Viktor Orban, the prime minister, has taken a harsh anti-migrant stance going back to 2015. That's when thousands of migrants, mainly from Syria, Afghanistan and Iraq, fled into Europe. But not all Hungarians with African backgrounds believe racism is on the up. Actor and radio presenter Sorel Arthur Kembe was born in Hungary and has roots in the Republic of the Congo. Kembe says he was attacked as a youngster.
In the early 90s, I had to fight a lot of skinhead groups in the streets. But I'm convinced now that this is over. We don't have to fight in the streets.
Kembe says racism is just not much of an issue in Hungary today.
Because here, we had never been segregated in restaurants, in buses, whatever. Hungary has a completely different historical and tradition of minority integration than, let's say, in France or Belgium.
Many of the black community who live in Hungary are African students on university scholarships. For the last 5 years, the government has actively promoted Hungarian degree courses to young people in Africa. István Tarossi, professor of political science and African studies at the University of Page, teaches many of those students. He says he finds it hard to square Orban's anti-migrant stance with the government's policy of bringing Africans to Hungarian colleges.
That's one of the questions I've been visiting and revisiting myself. And from an analytical point of view, it's a very consistent government policy, which is anti-immigrant. On the other hand, you can see these very pragmatic tools, such as this scholarship program.
Most of Tarossi's African students are aware of the government's anti-migrant rhetoric, he says. But he says few have experienced any racist abuse. András Liederer, with the human rights NGO, the Hungarian Helsinki Committee, says Hungary is being very strategic in its approach.
In every right-minded government, it is an idea to offer scholarships to foreign students and come and invite them to study in your own country in order to build strong personal relationships for potential future political and business and academic leaders.
Without knowing Hungarian, many of those students are unlikely to grasp the TV debates about the Black Lives Matter movement in Hungary. or understand the controversy over the miniature Statue of Liberty planned for Budapest. But Liedera says it's a mistake to underestimate the impact of all the negative messaging from pro-government TV channels. And watching events in Washington, D.C. on January 6th, he says, just makes that more clear.
Many of these people have been reading conspiracy theories for years, and that became the reality for them. And seeing how effective the Hungarian propaganda media is, one cannot help but wonder what will be the consequences of years of spreading vicious hate and conspiracy theories here in Hungary.
Artist Peter Solway says he's gotten some abuse since word of his art installation got out. But he says he's not too bothered by it just yet. He tells me that the fact that more people are talking about art is always a good thing. And if the statue gets torn down, he says, well, that will just prove how relevant the Black Lives Matter movement is in Hungary today. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The news right now is dizzying, so let us help. Our producers, reporters, and editors send out a daily newsletter about the stories we're following, so you're able to stay steady on your feet. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. Nawa Dumbia is one of Mali's legendary singers. She's 62 and still recording. Her songs continue to resonate with a younger generation, which is a good thing, because Nawa Dumbia has important messages for them. Sometimes those messages may not be what we'd expect in a song. In her latest work, Nawa Dumbia talks about emigrating and leaving Mali, as many have done. The title of the upcoming album, Kanawa, means don't go in the Bambara language. Dumbia sings, stay home and grow the land. Her point, change happens at home. With so many young men and women leaving Mali each year, Nawa Dumbia offers solutions in her music. Better job opportunities is one way, she sings, to get the young to stay. We leave you today with Nawa Dumbia's track, Foli Wilen. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.